My name is Earl, and I'm a veteran saint. I had a tie on, but Jack knocked me down and took it off and put it on. We both had the same operation. He thought wearing that tie might help him. If he was in medical school, he'd flunk his anatomy class because he put the tie around the wrong appendage. You know, I can't talk to an AA group of this size without recalling the 1955 conference where Ikey Sheridan introduced Bill. And he told a story which I'm sure that most of you have heard, but it typifies you and me. He said that in East Texas they had a little town, and in this town there was a sheriff, but they had no accommodations for a drunk if one should come along. So until better accommodations could be secured, they agreed that they would put the drunk in the local ice house. And sure enough, one came along, and they incarcerated him in the ice house. And that night at dinner, the little sheriff stood up suddenly and he said, "Oh, Emmy, I left old Joe down there in the ice house. I must go down and get him out." So he put on his hat and walked swiftly down the main street to the ice house. And he turned the big handle of a large creaking door and pulled it open. And there, huddled up in the corner, was a little old drunk who said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." I would like to address my remarks, of course, to each and every one of you, but with particular feeling, if you don't mind and will permit me, I would like to address my remarks to those drunks who have had minimal trouble. I would like to address my remarks to all of you, of course, but especially those who were not in jail, who did not have to go to a fidget farm, those who did not lose enormous amounts of money, those who did not lose their families, and those who were functioning units in this great society of ours. And yet, they, like I, came to an end point beyond which we could not go. And if those in this society who have had enormous trouble and who have lost virtually everything attack you, which they may or may not do, remember that those of us who are relatively high-bottom drunks are growing in leaps and bounds. We may overtake them yet. I made more money the last year of my drinking than I ever made before in my whole life. More than I've ever made sense, too. My bottom was predicated on an inordinate amount of success. Success came to me easily. In my younger days, I was admitted to medical organizations far beyond the time when I deserved it. Success followed me, but it was my undoing. Trials and tribulations in the monetary sense, in the tangible sense, were minimal.
Place is falling apart.
Trials and tribulations inside of me were maximal. All alcoholic bottoms, in terms of mood, in terms of feelings, are identical. It makes no difference whether the drunk comes to his bottom sitting in a beautiful, expensive home or on Skid Row. In his heart, the hurt is the same. All bottoms are the same. Now, some of you may not like that because you like to think that your bottom was unique.
But only Bailey and I have unique bottoms.
I'm not going to tell you about my drinking story except the last day. I might say a word or two. In my drinking time, I disappeared for long intervals, but when I returned, I had recovered and would go well for quite a period of time, progressively shorter. But the last day of my drinking was on the 1st of June, 27 years ago. And I took my little daughter out. She's now in her late 30s. She was a tiny thing at that time. I took her out to breakfast. And she was eating breakfast at Sam's restaurant in a little community known as Tiburon, across the bay from San Francisco. Some of you may know Sam's restaurant. And while she was eating breakfast in the restaurant, I was at the bar, and the memory is etched in within me indelibly, and I recall I ordered a Waring blender full of vodka fizzy and three double vodka martinis. You know, I drank vodka the last 6 or 7 years of my drinking. It's not supposed to smell your breath, you know, it just reeks through your pores, you know, all over the place. Well, I drank them down, and parenthetically, I like sweet drinks. Now, I also like straight drinks. The taste was unequivocal, but I like the burning sensation all the way down and going, it hits. But I also like sweet drinks. Now, I'm glad you're all sitting down, because when I drank, though I didn't eat, I ate reasonable amounts of candy. I was ashamed of that for a long time after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, a good two-fisted drinker is not supposed to eat candy while he drank. And then I read a book entitled John Barleycorn by Jack London. And Jack London ate candy when he drank, and he died a drunk. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for Jack, it's good enough for me. This particular day, on the 1st of June, 27 years ago, plus 2 days, I was not blacked out, as I had been so many, many times, but I was kind of browned out. And so I will tell you a few of the events that I do recall.
I don't recall leaving Sam's restaurant and going up the Tiburon Peninsula to my home in Mill Valley, but I do remember being on the deck. I now live in Kentucky, and we call it porch. And in Mill Valley, we call it a deck. And I was sitting there drinking Alexander's, and I had a tall 13-ounce glass that I had purchased in the dime store. It was plastic, and it had snow and ice on the outside of it, and it looked cool. It wasn't cool at all, but it looked cool. And I was drinking Alexander's. You know, that's supposed to be served mixed and with shaved ice, and I put a third of vodka, a third of cream de coco, and a third cream, and plunked a piece of ice in it and drank it down. It was a beautiful sunny day, and somewhere in the early afternoon, I found myself at a friend's house not too far away. Now, on this particular day, I was not concerned about my alcoholism. I had known that something strange was happening to me. I recall having to get up early in the morning and do a lot of exercise, which didn't help much because I had the hyperventilation syndrome, I thought, and I was shaking, and so I would leave for a day or two until that quieted down. Booze always stopped it. But on this particular day, I had reached a place where I thought I had the problem licked. Why I went to my friend's house, I don't know. He was a fraternity brother of mine at the university. I didn't know him too well, but reasonably well. And when I was there, he'd had a lot of trouble with alcohol. I did not seek him out looking for sobriety. I did not seek him out looking for AA. I just somehow was there for this day. I have no idea why I was there. He told me he'd been in AA for about 7 to 8 months, and he gave me a little pamphlet about the size of one of these pages here, about the size of this page, and on it were written several statements to the drinker who was contemplating stopping. He also gave me some AA pamphlets, not for me, and he told me later he didn't give this to me. I hid my drinking so much. He gave it to me as an example of the organization that he had entered. And this piece of paper that had statements on it, addressed to the drinker who was planning on stopping drinking, he had picked up, or had been mailed to him, I suspect, from some Eastern institution, I think Hazelden, actually. He gave it to me, and the next event I recall is being home on my deck trying to read it. But I was so drunk I couldn't make it out, so I had my wife read it to me. There were about 20 statements addressed to the active drinker who was contemplating stopping. Only two of them I recall. One of them said, "Don't stop drinking for anybody else except you." And the other one said, "Don't consider yourself a martyr because you stop drinking." And these two statements have made a very deep impact on me. It was as though somebody had turned up a beer towel and slapped me in the face. And I remember I broke down and cried. You know, crying was kind of par for the course in those days. I'd drive along in my car, and I'd hear Queen for a Day, and I'd cry. Well, you took my tie, I mean. Or I'd hear Bing Crosby sing, and I'd cry. Or I'd look at a cloud, and I would cry. I'd look at my wife and daughter, and I'd cry. I suppose they looked at me and cried, too. I don't know. My wife was a very good-natured soul, and she put her arms around me, and she said, "Well, I'm sure you'll be all right." By this time, it was about dinner time, 6 o'clock. and I walked up some flagstone stairs, about 20 of them, to the top. No, that didn't happen. I looked at my glass as I got to the top stair, and about this much was left in the bottom of the glass. I decided to turn around and come down the stairs to the kitchen and fill it up, return to the barbecue area, and I would have it there so I could make the, as I made the barbecue fire. As I turned around on the stairs, a literal explosion occurred inside of me. It literally ripped me apart. It was an exceedingly painful sensation. And the thought occurred to me, this is your last drink. And at that instant, so drunk I could hardly stand up, the craving to take another drink disappeared from me, and to this day has not returned. I recall the sun got brighter. I had an old warm overcoat that when it got wet, we didn't have raincoat that we do in these days. It was a load on my shoulders, and I felt as though someone had reached down and taken this heavy, wet, wind overcoat off my shoulders and dropped it to the ground. Well, it took me about 14 or 15 hours to really sober up. And the next day after that, I went up to see my friend, and I said, I'm in trouble. And I told him about my drinking. And he took me to my first AA meeting in the Wesley Hall at the Methodist Church in Nevada on a Tuesday night. And this was a meeting that I heard later was about to fold up. The members at the meeting had gotten less and less and less. It didn't. It survived. But at this meeting, there were four other people. There was a banquet table, 4 by 8, somewhat like this. It was actually one of these banquet tables here. At this end sat a man named Scott, miles up in the arena. He was a butcher. At that end sat a little bald-headed fellow, Shorty, aptly called Shorty. He was a carpenter. And on that side of the table sat a man named Vane, now unhappily deceased. He was a baker. And on this side of the table, next to me, sat my friend, who was kind of a ne'er-do-well inventor. And happily, he got drunk a couple of weeks later and was never heard of again. And I looked around at this motley group. And I said, now, what am I doing here? I have more letters after my name on fire than I have in it. And I have honors that have been bestowed on me and successes that have been offered to me that these men will never know. And I'm dealing with these kinds of people. So I said to Clark, may I be excused? And Clark was a very benevolent person, he said, by me. I walked outside of the Wesley Hall, and under a large linden tree, I took counsel with myself. And I said, do you mean to tell me that you, with all that you have, is positioned at purposeful length? And then I went down. All of the organizations that I belong to, in which honors have been bestowed on me, and I won't bore you with that. Do you mean to tell me, says I to me, that you've got to go back into that bare hall and get a butcher and a carpenter is a baker and a half-baked mechanic to make a man out of you? And after about 30 seconds, the thought occurred to me, you're damn right you do. You better turn around and go back in there. And I did. And never was a physician so grateful to a butcher and a carpenter and a baker and a mechanic as the one that stands before you 27 years later. About 8 months went by, and I had thought of a variety of things in my life, but one of them had not been spiritual maneuvers. And I went on a rampage. I bought all of the books I could think of, by Kelly, by Emma Fox. I had a Bible in my desk drawer at my office. I had a Bible by my nightstand. I had a Bible in my, I don't know why I got all Bibles, but I did. In my car, I had a Bible in my surgical locker at the hospital. And I joined a little group that was hot on spiritual things. And I floated up and up and up and up with this group that met extra AA. And I pretty soon was way up here in the clouds, and I felt absolutely miserable. And it struck me very clearly how terrible I felt. And I thought I might just as well be drunk as feel as I did. But I thought I'd give it one more shot. I went to a meeting on Sunday morning in a community known as San Rafael. Some of you may know it, not too far from where I live. And this was the San Rafael Breakfast Club. And there was a great big yak artist who was speaking at this meeting, who looked a lot like Clark Gable. And he had a strange, infectious laugh. And his name was Chuck C. I didn't like this guy because he made me feel good and I missed the agony. But strangely, I won at this breakfast a big book. And I met Chuck. Well, Chuck zeroed in on me. He didn't know I was a physician. He later said, if I had known you were a physician, I'd have dropped dead, but that's all right. And I felt better for quite a period of time. Maybe 3, 4, 5 years. And then I became, due to a series of rather strange circumstances, obsessed with finding serenity by the spiritual route. I had not found the serenity that I felt was my just due. And I went on a dry drunk that lasted 9 consecutive years. Now, I'm sure none of you have ever been on a dry drunk. I'm sure that none of you have ever had any troubles at all. I'm sure that all of you, when you sobered up, your life became beautiful and has stayed that way ever since. I'm sure that all of you only see joy and happiness and have since you hit your physical bottom. So I will have to exclude myself, if you'll permit me, from you. This did not happen to me. I quit my practice and went into the international medical scene. But the main reason I went on a long geographical trip was to look at other people in other cultures doing other things to find the serenity that I felt I was due. I spent a long time in Finland. I taught at Hennenlainen, northern part of Finland, and it's there I saw a never-ending day. I taught and went to meetings, both AA and otherwise, in Britain, Scotland, and Ireland. I went to meetings in Paris. They were all lovely meetings, and I kept looking at people and thought to myself, maybe you've got it. Maybe you've got it. And I kept looking at people as I passed them on the street, and I became obsessed with this. I had to find the serenity that was my just due. And I've got letters from people telling me I had lost my mind, and I suspect that I had. I've got letters telling me that I was plumb crazy, and I suspect that I was. One of the most miraculous meetings was in Rome, 5 people, and I thought maybe I could get the serenity from them. Maybe they had the answer. And then, due to a series of miraculous circumstances, I ended up in Southeast Asia. And on the way there, I spent a short time in Iran, and this is a terrible place because no one even drank there. And I'm not going to belabor you with all that occurred to me, but I spent more time in the lotus position in Buddhist temples than you will ever see. Now, I want to tell you, and please, I'm not putting anyone down. Meditation in the lotus position, saying Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om, 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 and I could go on to several others, quiets down your mind, but you become as dull as hell. I spent time in Bali. I spent time in Saigon. My medical work took me to the University of Saigon, and I walked all over Saigon, looking at the temples. I walk in the bowels of Cholon, where even the Vietnamese wouldn't go. It's the Chinese sector, but I went there, smelling the smell, sensing the mystery, the mystique, the lights, and I did this night and day. I went to Denpasar in Bali. I spent time in Singapore. One of the best AA meetings I ever attended, by the way, in my life was in Singapore. They're all crazy. They're all semen. They're all mavericks. I'm one, aren't you? In Bangkok, Taipei, and then I landed in India. And I lotused India from Madras to Bangalore, to Bombay, and I even returned once to Singapore because I knew there was a street in Singapore where you could go if you were going to die. And you could carry a little change in your pocket, and when you die, this change would help you pay for your cremation. And I went and sat there for 48 hours hoping I would die. But they asked me to leave. There's a holiday known as Diwali in India. And Diwali is kind of like our New Year's Eve. It comes in November. And it's a great washing when you become new. And I was staying at an ashram that was where the disciples of Ramani Maharshi were. I had just come from one in Pondicherry, where there was another great saint. But I was on this Diwali in the ashram just outside of Pondicherry, and I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and here were great cauldrons flaming with hot oil. and they would ladle out vast amounts of this oil into a bucket, and you put warm water in that, and you went into a small room and you bathed yourself and you put on a dhoti, and then you walked around a mountain known as Arunachala, which means sun. And you walk around this mountain barefoot, 8 miles, saying Arunachala Shiva, Arunachala Shiva, Arunachala Shiva, 8 count 'em miles. Thinking that maybe the spirit in this great mountain would invade me and give me the serenity that I either lost or felt was mine. After a great number of years, I was in my apartment in Saigon. The war had been over. I had nothing to do with the war, by the way. And I realized I was cornered. I had been on macrobiotic diets, I had been on microbiotic diets. I had been a vegetarian, I had done nothing but eat meat, as the American Indians do. I had done all of these things looking for the serenity that I thought you had promised me. I didn't get. I was sober, but I felt absolutely boxed in a jail, a psychological prison. And suddenly I fell to my knees, not praying, out of sheer exhaustion. And I lay on the floor, and the struggle to search disappeared from me at that instant. And I recalled how I felt in Mill Valley when I had that spiritual experience that burst inside of me, which took the craving to drink away from me. I felt that way as I lay on the floor, and I said to myself, since you have sobered up, you have hit many, many bottoms. This is the worst one you ever experienced. Excluding perhaps the physical one. But the urge to search disappeared from me at that time. And then my brain started to act a little bit, and it said to me, do you suppose that the bottom is really the top? Do you suppose that the bottom is really God? Do you suppose that the bottom is really serenity? And then I started to laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. Because I didn't care whether those intellectual questions ever got answered to me. And I fell asleep. I awakened. And then it occurred to me what you had said to me. Rarely has a person failed who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose what they used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And some of these we thought we could find an easier path. softer way that we could know. With all of the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough. From the very start, some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, and so we let go. Absolutely. Remember, dear one, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We start at the turning point. We ask his protection care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took. What is suggested as a program of recovery. Let me put three hyphens there and tell you what I think may have happened to me and to you. And let me change the course of my dissertation, if we can call it that, for a moment. As children, don't you recall? We found ourselves looking up into the sky, and there was a pipeline directly to something that said, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. And then you and I, as little kids filled with the joy of living, came into the mothering one. I don't mean a mother. I don't mean a father. I don't mean a community. I don't mean a nation, except I mean all of those. And we said to the mothering one, oh, I love you. And the mothering one turned to us and said, have you done the dishes yet? And we said to ourselves, well, I haven't done the dishes yet, but what happened to my statement? And we went outside, and we thought about this for a while. We looked up, and that pipeline was still there. It didn't seem to be quite as bright, but it was still there. Then we came in one day, and we said, oh, Mama, and I don't mean a woman, I mean anyone. I love you. And I just learned how to skate. And the mother one turned to us and said, be careful you don't fall down. And we said to ourselves, that's pretty good advice, but what happened to my enthusiasm about skating? And we went outside and we pondered that for a while. And then we came back in, and we were about to say, I love you again, and we recalled this didn't quite get accepted, and this angered us, and we said to the mothering one, and I don't mean a mother, I hate you. And we got up in the side of the face, and the mothering one said to us, you don't speak that way to me. And so we went outside, and we didn't know quite which way to go. And we looked up, and that pipeline directly to God knows where had disappeared. And we didn't know which way to turn. What do? What do you say? How do you act? You couldn't love him, and you couldn't hate him, and you couldn't... What do? And so we built a wall around ourselves, and we decided that we would hate them, we would despise them forevermore. And we agreed and drew up a contract with ourselves that if we ever denied the fact that we hated them, we hereby said, for the future reference, I will not have meant it. I hate them. And we went around life immobile in saying thank you, How do you do? Please? And inside, we had died. And all of a sudden, a groovy cat came up to us and said, "Baby, try some of this." And it was a brown liquid, and we knocked it off, and zoo, part of that pipeline came back. And we were all right, and this wall disappeared. And we felt magnificent, and we said to our groovy cat friend, "Where can I get some more of that?" And he showed us where. And we thought we had it made. And we drank more of this kind and that kind. And sometimes it was sweet and sometimes it wasn't. And sometimes it was vodka and sometimes it was bourbon. And it was all great until one day it backfired on us and it didn't give us. That pipeline was gone again. And we were panicky. We didn't know what to do. And so we got some more of this stuff and drank some more, and it didn't ever come back. And this went on for X number of years. And one day we fell down in a dusty road with our face on the ground. And we said, "Take me. Take me. I can't stand it. I want to die." Don't you know, a fella came up to us and took us by the hand and said, "Come with me." And we said, "What for?" "Well, I don't know. I'd just like to have you come with me." We kind of liked this guy, but not too well. And we went with him to a little house. And inside that house were some people that were doing nothing but drink coffee. And we said, "What did you bring me here for?" He said, "Well, we thought maybe you'd like it here." And we said, "Like it here? I wouldn't stay here for nothing. I hate it." And he said to us, "Yes, I know you do. But won't you stay just a little bit longer?" And so we sat down and talked to this fellow, and we said, "What do you have here?" He said, "Well, we don't really have very much." He said, "What keeps you going here?" He said, "Well, we aren't really quite sure." "Who is the president of your organization here?" And he said, "Well, we don't really have any." And we said, "Good God, I gotta get out of this place. It's not organized." And so we started towards the door, and he said, "Won't you have another cup of coffee?" And so we did. And he said to us, "We, like you, have fallen with our face in the dust. And we, like you, have been in the same trouble you have been in." And we said to him, "Prove it." And this guy told us what he had done with booze. And we became fascinated. And when he finished at the end of several hours telling us what he had done with booze, we said to him, "Yeah, that's the way I drank." And this guy smiled at us and said, "We know that." We said, "How do you know that?" "Because you have all of the earmarks of us." And we looked at him in the eye and started to tell him how we had drunk and what we had done. And finally there was built up an intensity, a passion, and our two eyes joined. And as they joined, we were at the same level of intensity, and we were healed. And we said, "You're some kind of a mystical something." He said, "No, I'm really not. I'm just like you, except Here are 12 principles that have become us. We don't follow those 12 principles. We are those 12 principles. We don't follow anything. We even have 12 traditions. The last one says that we put principles above personality. We don't put principles anyplace. We are those principles. And we thought he was nuts, and we ran towards the door, and we walked outside to get a breath of air. And we looked up, and there was a pipeline in segments. It was a little bit fragmented, but there it was. It wasn't quite as we had remembered it as a child. We didn't understand this, and we went back in. And he said to us, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And he said, yeah, that happened to me too. And he said to us, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, not somebody else. And we said to this fellow, if you're going to turn your life over to something else, that means that I've got to say to myself, I'm nothing. And he smiled and said, you ain't nothing. And we didn't like that. And we said, do you mean to tell me that I got to give up running my life? And he smiled and said, no, you don't have to do anything. But how you doing? You fell on your face and cried, God, baby. And we started to comprehend what he was talking about. He walked to the door with us. And we walked outside together. And there was the pipeline. The pipeline direct to Shiva, to God. I don't care what you call it. And then he nudged us and said, see that fellow over there with his face in the dust? And we said, yes, he did. And we had a feeling as though he was saying, you better go do the dishes. But he wasn't. He was looking at that fellow over there and at the same time looking at us. He said, go over and get him. And we said, well, I don't know what to do. And he said, you don't have to know what to do. Take him by the hand and bring him to our house. And he went over to this guy and he took him and said, give me a hand and come with me. And he said, I don't want to go with you. And that frightened us, and we looked back. And the guy who had given us his hand was standing in the door, and he was saying, yeah, do it again. So he reached down again and said, give me your hand and come with me. And the fellow got up, and as he did, all of the dust turned into cool grass. And slowly you and I walked with him to the door and walked inside. And you and I held the man's hand in our left hand and the older man's hand in our right. And we read together, made a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. And this guy struggled, and we grabbed hold and said, take it easy, it's all right. Everything's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. He said, it's all right. It's going to be all right. Don't worry. We'll give you a cup of coffee in just a minute. They got lots of coffee here. And he went down all of those 12 steps. And then we took that fellow in and sat him down. And in front of this fellow we had just brought in, and the fellow who had brought us in, there were 1,620 people gathered together in a beautiful dining room. And we said to ourselves, are all these people the same? Have they gone on similar kinds of trips? Have they fallen on their knees and their Saigon? Have they gone around their Arunachala Siva in their own way? And all 1,620 said, yeah, baby, we have, just the same. And we mused, what was it that kept this diverse group together when the great doctor of our society could not give us and the 1,620 people in this great ballroom the kind of sobriety that we just had to have? And we started to muse, how come the great psychiatrists of the world, great they are, were not able to give this 1,620 people in the three of us the kind of sobriety that we had to have? And how come the great men of the cloth were unable to give us the kind of sobriety that we must have? How come that we said to ourselves, probably no human power could have relieved us of our insanity? How come we said that? And as we stood in front, my new man and the man that had taken me, and in front of the 1,620, there was a quiet in that room. And we all listened to it. And we agreed that it was God. God bless you all.